Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at ThomisticInstitute.org.
Well, the vocation of parenthood. So it's my pleasure to introduce the Peters, Dr. Nathaniel and Professor Jane Peters. Professor Jane Sloan Peters is Assistant Professor of Religious Studies at the College of Mount St. Vincent in Riverdale, New York. Her dissertation explored Thomas Aquinas' reception of the Greek, patristic, and Byzantine biblical interpretation for his four-volume commentary on the Gospels, the Catena Aurea. Now, Professor Peters has a number of TI talks that I thought you'd be interested to hear, if you haven't already, what's on option for your chapter. ChatGPT and the Foolishness of Speech, why human Communication Matters. And Finding Truth and Friendship During the College Years, Jacques and Reyes Maritain's Journey to Thomas Aquinas, a married couple and their journey in college. Finding Aquinas, and then cultivating a Benedictine life of prayer and work in the world with the help of Thomas Aquinas. Just a little sampling there. And Dr. Nathaniel Peters is director of the Morningside Institute, which is located Columbia University. That's the right there in Manhattan. He received his BA from Swarthmore College in linguistics with a focus in French and Latin, and his master's in theological studies from Notre Dame, and a PhD from Boston College. He has published articles and reviews on many topics in historical theology and ethics, and serves as a contributing editor of Public Discourse. And some of Dr. Peter's talks are Monks, Clerics, and Female Mystics, An Introduction to Medieval Theology, Can You Have Human Dignity Without Christianity, and How to Choose a Good Life. That seems like an especially apt one for all of us. Most significantly, Nathaniel and Jane have been married for 9 years, and they have two sons and one on the way. So please welcome the Peters.
Well, thank you, Father John Mark. Thank you all for being here. So at this point in our lives, any time that Jane and I are out of the house without the children, even if it's like to move bookcases at her office, it's basically a date. So we want to thank you for coming to our date at the Dominican House of Studies. And we'll also be giving some talks, but you know, thank you for joining us along for that. So in his catechetical work on the Articles of Faith, Thomas Aquinas writes, "Matrimony has a threefold good. The first is the birth of children and the educating of them to the worship of God. The second is that fidelity which one must render to the other. And the third is that it is a sacrament, or in other words, the indivisibility of matrimony, which shows forth the indivisible union of Christ and his church." So we might more succinctly say that marriage has three goods: a procreative good, a unitive good, and a sacramental good. And we'll discuss children and procreation more in the second talk. But in this talk, I'm going to speak about the unitive good of marriage and friendship, and I'm going to focus maybe on the more natural parts of marriage. And Jane is going to speak more about marriage's supernatural orientation. And in the applications that we read for this, we noticed there was some interest in hearing a bit more about chastity. So if we have time, we'll throw in some stuff on that. And if not, we'll hopefully over lunch, we'll be able to break up. I'll have lunch with the guys. She'll have lunch with the girls. And you can kind of ask us questions about the talk or marriage or sort of general. It can be like a quadlibital session in the Middle Ages where you can just ask us anything. So we can get into other things if we miss them or you want us to expand them. So it's common to the point of cliche to hear engaged couples or newlyweds talk about how excited they are to marry their best friend. And then other people, you know, have kind of come to object to this, right? There's a need to maintain marriages outside of friendship, lest you're burdening your spouse kind of with more expectations than he or she can bear. People will say, well, there's no such thing as a soulmate, which I think there's some point to, but we can get into that later. Nonetheless, in his discussion of why marriage is indissoluble in the Summa Contra Gentiles, Thomas writes that, quote, there seems to be the greatest friendship between husband and wife, for they're united not only in the act of fleshly union, which produces a certain gentle association even among beasts, but also in the partnership of the whole range of domestic activity. So friends share life together, and the fact that husbands and wives share their entire lives would seem to make them best friends. And I think if we examine Thomas's understanding of friendship, especially in his commentary on Aristotle's Nicomachean Ethics, we can gain some insights into this connection that he makes between virtuous friendships and strong marriages. So in the Nicomachean Ethics, Aristotle begins his treatment of friendship by arguing that friendship is a good that all must pursue if they seek to live a happy life. And friendship, at least in its perfect form, is not an incidental good that we pursue in order to gain other things like wealth or power, but we seek friendship because it's a sharing in the or a participation in the life of another. And so friendship, as Aquinas captures it, is an exchange of love that takes place in repeated acts of goodness from one friend to another. And those of you who have sort of some of Thomas running in your head as an operating system will hear, oh, okay, repeated acts of love. That sounds like friendship might be habitual, right? So because it's a habitual act of free choice, friendship is almost like a kind of virtue. Right? So even when friends aren't performing acts of friendship, right, when they're apart or when they're sleeping, they can be said to be friends because they habitually, quote, live together pleasantly and do good for one another, unquote. Now, this degree of pleasure and good is not equally present in all forms of friendship. And again, those of you who have read the Nicomachean Ethics before, you know that Aristotle famously identifies three kinds of friendship based on three objects of love or three reasons for friendship, right? There's friendship for the honorable good or the good as such. There's friendship for pleasure, and there's friendship for use or what's useful, right? And Aristotle and Aquinas both think that only the good who seek friendship for the sake of pursuing the good and who do that with people who are good can know true friendship. So in a virtuous friendship, right, a virtuous person loves his or her friend because the friend is familiar to himself. He loves him as another self, which is to say that he feels for his friend what he feels for himself. And that kind of a friendship begins with feelings of goodwill, right, or a favorable disposition towards someone based on various natural qualities that they might have. But that goodwill kind of continues in the friendship, and it's joined by acts of beneficence and by concord in mind and heart. And this is possible because the friends are alike in virtue. Their virtue impels them to make repeated acts of love. And because virtue is a permanent habit, these acts of love become a permanent, lasting relationship. Now, I don't want to claim that Jane and I are super, super virtuous people, but something kind of like this happened with us. And one of the things we want to do today is kind of draw on our own experiences, but also give you a lot of Aquinas. So hopefully if you're coming more for the one or more for the other, you'll be satisfied. So Jane and I, we had met before we were in the same place once without meeting, and then we met another time. But we got to know each other when we were both in graduate school, and we were living near each other with mutual friends. So she and her housemates would come over for drinks or for dinner or vice versa. We would go over there. She worked part-time at a bakery. So sometimes she came with leftover bread and pastries, which is a great friend to have, right? But that would be a friendship of use, not a friendship, not a virtuous friendship. And then one day I borrowed her car to go to a dentist appointment. And it turns out that you learned a lot about a person when you crash her car, especially when she barely knows you. And after misreading a traffic light at a terrible intersection on a rainy night in Boston, which is its own special kind of driving, I returned to Jane's house to find that she was not upset, but she was very kind. She was calm, and she was more concerned for my well-being than that of her green Honda Civic. And so I paid the deductible, we got the car fixed, but I was very struck by the mercy that she showed me in all of that. And that willingness to be merciful with each other, to bear with one another's weaknesses and faults, as I think you probably heard in Colossians the other night, has proved to be, I think, one of the strengths of our marriage. So this resonance for Aquinas, coming back to Aquinas, between a friendship of virtue and a healthy marriage, I think you should already have seen some of them as I was, or being, you should have been able to kind of connect the dots as I was describing Aquinas' view of friendship, right? And the connections between friendship and marriage also appear when you consider friendship's frequency, its cultivation, and the number of people who can compose a friendship. So first, because virtuous people are rare, virtuous friendship is rare. Second, virtuous friendship requires time and discernment, right? You need to find out who's virtuous. You need to kind of figure out whether someone is really good, whether you really want to be that person's friend. And third, a virtuous friendship can really only be with one person. And Aquinas gives three reasons for this. First, he says, the kind of superabundant love present in virtuous friendship is by nature designed for one person, as is evident in sexual love. So already you see that connection there in his commentary. Second, friends are extremely pleasant to one another, and this is difficult to maintain with more than one person. I would add, it's difficult to maintain even with just one person. But third, friends become closer with each other by habitual association, right? And it's hard to have that with a whole bunch of people. And fourth, so those are the three. Friendship is hard, and this can only happen with one person. So friendship, in short, is difficult, right? It might be natural to us, but it requires time and it requires effort, and it's infrequent because of its exclusivity and the rarity of virtue. But if your friend remains virtuous, you remain virtuous, the friendship results in a twofold benefit. So first, friends enjoy a friendship because they enjoy each other, right? Each is another self to the other. Each delights in the other. And just as a good man rejoices at the good that he performs, so he rejoices in the good that his friend performs, right? Because he loves the good, because his friend contains the good, the virtuous man loves his friend's very existence. And he wants to live together with him, to share himself with him, to receive himself in turn, right? And this is also what I think happens in good and healthy marriages, especially friendships that are on their way to progressing to marriage. And this is what happened with Jane and me. We got to know each other better over time in contexts that were not related to car insurance companies. One night to celebrate the feast of St. Thomas Aquinas, Jane and her housemate, who is now a philosopher in Paris, arrived with some rum and with a fire poker in case things got out of hand. If you don't get the fire poker joke with Aquinas, we'll tell you about that over lunch. But there's a great picture of the three of us with the fire poker and a bottle of Kraken. I finished my comprehensive exams. I traveled a bit. I was still kind of thinking about the religious life, the priesthood. So I visited a couple of communities, including the Dominicans in New York City. And in the meantime, one day in the novitiate common room in an Austrian canonry, I sort of discovered via email that Jane had broken up with the person she was dating. And I said, why do I have feelings about this? That's interesting. Well, I have a lot of tourist things to do. I'm not going to worry about those. And like many men, I put my feelings back in the drawer and went off and did other things. But they came back. And one day I was praying at a church in New York City and I was kind of thinking about vocations. And it was almost like if it had been a movie with tacky special effects, like the word Jane would have just like appeared over the altar. And I was like, oh. And it was one of those things where, well, that wasn't really supposed to happen. But, you know, over time, the thing that I think was fruitful was that prayer, discernment, had allowed clarity to emerge about what I actually desired, even if it wasn't clear to me what I had desired. And I think that was also not just a clarity about what I desired, but how I desired to love and how God had formed me to love. My desires for Jane and my desires to be a father were obscured to me. And in a kind of Augustinian sense, I didn't know myself, right? I had to kind of discover myself over time. And so earlier we had had a conversation to clarify that we were just friends. We were two pilgrims who were kind of found each other along the way. We were going to go our separate ways. I proposed an amendment to that conversation. And we went on a date to see if there was more there. And as we sat in the public garden in Boston with a picnic dinner, it's sort of odd to phrase it this way, but I felt like I was plunging into an ocean of mercy. And that's still something that I don't fully fathom, but I can't find a better way to describe. And so 8 months later, we were engaged, and then we were married the year after that, and here we are today. So in addition to kind of this growth in the joy of living with and knowing a kindred spirit, virtuous people take delight in friendship because it helps them become more virtuous, right? Because we have affections for ourselves, kind of we're blinded to our own actions. We don't necessarily judge our actions well. And so we sometimes need to see the actions of a virtuous friend, right, who's kind of like another self in order to grow in virtue, right? We need to study another self, who we love in the way that we love ourselves. So two friends love what is good in each other. Through their friendship, they become goods to each other. Each wishes the good for the other's sake, not for his or her own. And this mutual love, Aquinas says, makes friendship not exactly a virtue, but he says something above a virtue because, quote, the act of one is not sufficient, but the act of two mutually loving one another must concur, unquote. Friendship, therefore, isn't only a matter of pursuing your own virtue, but of wanting to help your friend become better as well. And so in finding another self, a friend has found a way to work for virtue in more than himself or in more than herself, right? You're working for virtue in another person too. So if all these sort of aspects of friendship that I've laid out, if these are the structure of a good friendship, let me suggest four ways in which the sharing of life between a husband and wife can make marriage the greatest friendship, like Aquinas said. So first, a good marriage is founded on the good that the spouses perceive in each other. It allows spouses to delight in each other, to rejoice in each other's good, and in the mutual enjoyment of the good that you share. Second, a good marriage begins with feelings of goodwill. It begins with attraction, right? And then it's joined to beneficence, doing good to each other, and a concord of mind and heart, right? That means you're not going to necessarily agree on everything, but you hold enough in agreement that you can be at peace with each other, that you can build a life together. Marriage entails doing and willing the good for your spouse constantly, even when you don't feel like it, and making your spouse's good your own. And marriage requires and enables enough agreement. So that you can live in peace, right? Even if you don't fully agree on religion or politics or something else, right? Three, a good marriage can help you become more virtuous. And this is both joyful and extremely difficult. I think more so than anything else in life, at least this has been my experience, marriage and children show you just how self-centered you are. And they're like a boot camp for training you to become centered on the good of another person. And for Christians, marriage is the path to sanctity that God has prepared for the spouses. And sanctity and virtue, as difficult as they are, they allow us to flourish and to live more perfectly a life animated by God's love. Fourth, a good marriage entails building and sharing a good life with another person, both the diverse goods that we enjoy together in this life and ultimately our enjoyment of goodness itself, which is life with God in the next. So to put it maybe another way, Christian marriage is a shared pilgrimage to life with God in heaven, and that ultimate goal can help spouses keep in perspective the joys and the sorrows that they experience. Now, in the supplement to the Summa Theologiae, and as you may know, the Summa has three parts that Aquinas wrote, and then he didn't finish the Summa, so after his death, his students kind of compiled a supplement to the Summa based on his lectures and his writings. And so in the supplement, Aquinas shows how grace builds on and expands the friendship of marriage in making the natural union into a sacrament. And Aquinas considers one of the first things in the supplement on marriage. Aquinas considers an argument that marriage is not a sacrament because the sacraments derive their efficacy from Christ's passion. And it seems like marriage involves pleasure, i.e. sexual pleasure. And so therefore, it doesn't conform us to Christ's passion, which is painful. And in response to this argument, Aquinas writes, although marriage is not conformed to Christ's passion as regards to pain, it is as regards to charity, whereby he suffered for the church who was to be united to him as his spouse. And to me, you'll find this if you read the Summa, there are moments where Aquinas' prose is sort of like a prism that refracts light into a ray of colors, or it's sort of like walking through the door of a Gothic cathedral and kind of coming into a large expanse. And for me, this is one of those moments, right? So Aquinas is saying that in marriage, the spouses give themselves to each other and lay down their lives for each other totally, just as Christ did for us on the cross. And it's that total and faithful self-gift that allows marriage to be an image of Christ's self-gift for the church. And I think there are three things that follow from this. So first, the married couple's gift of themselves becomes the path by which they imitate Christ and become Christ-like. Second, in the sacrament of marriage, God gives us his love so that we can love as he does. And then thirdly, marriage is also the place where we should receive God's love through the self-gift of our spouse. And so God shows us, in an ideal sense, but in a healthy marriage, God shows us what his love looks like by how our spouse loves us. That third one was, for me, a surprise. I kind of had a sense of, oh, yes, you know, especially because Ephesians tells you, if you're the husband, Ephesians tells you to do this very clearly, lay down your life for your wife. Oh, okay, I've got to do that. Okay. So, but I didn't know that I was going to learn more about God's love from the way my wife would love me. Now, conceived in this way, I think it makes sense for someone to say that he's married his best friend. I think that doesn't have to be a cliche. The friendship of husband and wife is founded on some kind of attraction or thrill, we hope, but that thrill has roots in the good of another person, in that person's goodness, and that friendship should grow into a series of actions that make both spouses better, that cement their delight in each other's good, in a life of mutual beneficence and sacrifice. And empowered by grace, their marriage can become an icon of God's love, however imperfectly, and a means of their growth in that love toward its full flowering in the beatific vision. So I think we could add to Aquinas that not only is marriage conformed to Christ's passion as regards to charity, but it's also conformed to Christ's resurrection. It can be healing and it can be transformative, giving joy now and in the life to come. So now I'm going to turn it over to Jane.
Good morning. Thank you for being here, and thank you for your witness to life as well yesterday. I would like to pick up where Nathaniel left off with thinking about marriage as a sacrament, and particularly think about how sacramental grace sort of takes up and transforms those natural goods of marriage that he spoke about, like friendship. So one of Aquinas' famous phrases is, grace does not destroy nature, but perfects it. And this is certainly applicable to his treatment of marriage, which incorporates Aristotle's treatment of friendship, but offers much more. And as people discerning marriage in the Christian faith, I wanted to encourage you to be very intentional about learning to recognize the aspects of marriage that pertain to the life of grace. Marriage is in a bit of a funny situation today. We know the problems that that our culture has with marriage. But there are also many goods of marriage that sacramental marriage has in common with a more secular view. Things like the desire for companionship, the desire to build a life together and bring children into that life, to have an enriching home life conducive to bringing up children that are happy and of good character. On the other hand, it is evident that secular and sacramental conceptions of marriage differ greatly in the details of how to achieve all those desirable things. So we have to be vigilant because among the many goods presented by the secular conceptions of marriage, there also lie distortions. And as Christians, we could be tempted to lower our horizon or to reduce the concept of marriage and family life merely to those goods. One quick example, when we were planning our wedding, I found myself on Instagram looking at a lot of different accounts and wondering if I should spend an extra $12 per chair for our wedding reception. And I thought, what is happening to me? $12 per chair for a wedding reception. Okay, set that aside, right? And now as a mom, there's lots of parenting information, lots of parenting information, how to be a good parent, ways you're a totally crappy parent. Some of it resounds with the faith and some of it doesn't. Right. So the task for my portion of the talk is just to review Aquinas' description of the three goods of marriage and to do so with a supplement, which Nathaniel mentioned, and also with some of his scripture commentaries. And in my assessment, you know, the supplement, even though it was compiled by students and friends, it's pretty consistent with Aquinas' overall thought on marriage, and especially when you start to look at the scripture commentaries, which were originally given as lectures in a classroom and written down, we see that he has quite a bit to say. So the first good of marriage is offspring, the production and education of children, which today is called the procreative end of marriage. This has been mischaracterized frequently as the church's obsession with demanding couples have as many children as possible without regard for prudential judgment or personal well-being. I think even well-meaning people can mischaracterize this aspect of marriage. One of the things growing up that I thought about was that when I had kids, I wanted to have 8 so that there were enough for a 5-on-5 basketball team. That's very charming, but it has no sense of, you know, collaboration with a spouse or anything practical, right? But the reality of the teaching of Thomas is quite different. And in fact, Aquinas addresses an objector who is concerned with this same misinterpretation. Is the good of marriage only about begetting and feeding? The objector asks. And Thomas replies that the term offspring signifies not only the begetting of children, but also their education, to which as its end is directed the entire communion of works that exists between man and wife as united in marriage. So openness to children is a cornerstone upon which married couples build their entire lives and relationships. And on the one hand, this is a natural good of marriage. On the other hand, Christian marriage further sanctifies and directs this end. Aquinas notes that the education of children is an act of the virtue of religion, which falls under the cardinal virtue of justice, since we aim to raise children who will worship God. And he would agree, I think, with St. John Paul II, who said that saints beget and raise saints. We'll have more time to talk about the education and rearing of children in the second talk. So here, I will offer only a few brief thoughts. When Nathaniel and I promised during our wedding vows to be open to children, we were completely sincere and mostly clueless. During our engagement, we had spoken about the ups and downs of our own childhoods, how many children we saw ourselves having, and we spent time with many friends who had small children, and we sketched a very rough outline of what our home might look like and what education of children might look like. But it all seemed very abstract. I mostly thought about how kids who look like Nathaniel would be cute. One of the surprises of marriage for me is how our work of having and raising children together has become so naturally enfolded in our friendship. Here are a couple examples. We've always made a point to pray together, but one of my favorite memories and practices I cherish is when we are praying night prayer in bed at night, the divine office, when I'm pregnant, my huge, ever-growing pregnant belly between us and the baby kind of kicking away as we pray together. Because children can hear in the womb from about 24 weeks, this has always struck me as an important way to introduce prayer and for the child to hear the mother and the father's voices going back and forth as they say night prayer. We're also avid readers, and now we love building our children's library. We've always loved Christmas together, and now we are especially intentional about how we celebrate it. How do we convey our love for our boys and our gratitude for the incarnation. We've recovered some lost family traditions on his side, like marking the door of our home with chalk for the Epiphany and singing carols around the tree. Some of our efforts land better than others. My first child turned every Montessori activity I tried into a story about garbage and garbage trucks. And I distinctly remember a children's Holy Week altar that I tried to collaboratively set up, which ended up without a crucifix, but with a copy of the Da Vinci Code on it. But the point is that as we raise children, we find the most important aspects of our friendship deepening. At night before we go to sleep, it's always, you know, the funny thing John said today or the funny thing George said today. And these are the things that delight us and that we take delight in together. We delight in how the other person loves the children, and we love the unique things that the other person brings to being a mother or father. Very little of this was evident to us as we were, you know, dating and engaged, and it's a real gift to see that sort of grow in our marriage. I think that's a work of grace. The second good of marriage is fidelity to one's spouse. And like offspring, fidelity is a natural good that has been transformed by the sacrament. Aquinas writes that every sacrament contains a sanctifying remedy against sin offered to man under sensible signs. So marriage offers not only the grace to maintain the fidelity to one another, but a remedy for the human imperfections that threaten it. In several places, he calls the sacrament of marriage a remedium peccate, a remedy for sin, or a remedium concupiscentiae, a remedy for concupiscence. And this idea, too, has been badly distorted and labeled out of touch with the reality of married love, as though Thomas thinks that human conjugal love were an unthinking, animalistic impulse, and marriage is for those of us with little sanctity who cannot help indulging ourselves in such shameful behavior. But I think this is a really unfortunate misinterpretation of a beautiful aspect of divine providence. And Aquinas anticipates this view and condemns it in several places. In the 41st question of the supplement, he addresses objections that the marriage act is always sinful. And the third objection proposes that sexual union is always connected with concupiscence, which is always shameful, so sex must be always sinful. In the reply, Aquinas grants that concupiscence comes with shame, but reminds us that concupiscence itself is not a sin. Rather, it is a consequence of original sin and a distortion of our natural desires, such as desires for food, sex, and other pleasures, inasmuch as those desires refuse to be directed by reason. And this is important for two reasons. First, because the doctrine of original sin and its corresponding depiction of concupiscence is a revealed truth that, when received in faith, gives us the good news that the miserable experience of being driven by disordered lower passions is both not the life God created us for and not in itself a sin for which we bear guilt. So those who take offense at the idea that marriage is somehow a remedy for concupiscence are implying that they have a problem with being told that their passions are disordered, as though this is some kind of personal failure. Are they willing to admit that none of us know what it is like to look at another person like Adam and Eve looked at one another before the fall? Do they also take offense at sacraments like reconciliation or Eucharist, which provide similar remedies? It's also important because it means that marital union is not a consolation prize for those who cannot really attain sanctity, say through the Dominican life. It is a path to sanctity despite original sin. I think that there's a text from the marriage liturgy that's really beautiful, and I quote it in full on your handout, but part of it says that marriage is the one blessing not forfeited by original sin, nor washed away by the flood. So the grace of the sacrament, the remedium, heals spouses of the many, many wounds that compromise the unity they aspire to and allow the virtue of fidelity to be accomplished in charity. This is a great mercy on God's part. It speaks to the same gratuitous love by which the Word became flesh for our salvation. And these remarks of Aquinas's, I think, harmonize very well with the modern church's characterization of marriage and family as a school of love and a school of deeper humanity. To bring this back to friendship, we could say that as concupiscence deals with disordered desires of many kinds, not just sexual, the good of fidelity deals not just with sexual fidelity, but with the fidelity of persons to one another in all dimensions of life. And in marriage, we are constantly healing. We are constantly being challenged to think about someone other than ourselves in the smallest of ways. I, for example, am learning to fold my napkin after breakfast. Nathaniel now knows that when I say you can have a bite of a croissant, that does not mean the whole thing. The third good of marriage is what marriage signifies, namely the love of Christ for the church. And there are two aspects of this. And the first is the indissolubility of the union. When Nathaniel and I got married, neither of us expected our marriage to survive on the strength of our love alone. And this was a great gift, because we knew that going into marriage, we were asking God to be with us and to help us to be faithful to one another. So indissolubility is a very important grace given in the sacrament. And it really, in my experience, feels as though there is a third person in our marriage kind of sustaining us and directing us and expanding our love and enlivening our life together. I need grace to live the kind of friendship Nathaniel and I are called to, because I cannot give what I do not have. On difficult days when I have been a jerk to everyone and rejected the opportunities for self-sacrifice in family life in favor of a very lonely kind of self-pity and indignation, and when I am convinced that I am finally completely unlovable, Nathaniel knows that a very gentle touch on the shoulder is the first thing that will bring me around. And with this, I can come to my senses and apologize. He then reminds me that he does not want to take me back to the wife store. And however late in the evening it is, it can still be a good day. This is one of the most concrete experiences of that sacramental grace that I have. And I think Nathaniel's right when he says that God shows us what his love looks like through the spouse, and that that's been one of the most beautiful surprises of marriage. The second part of the sacramental good of marriage is that marriage signifies Christ's union with his bride, the church. Thomas doesn't have a ton to say on that except to say that. And I find that when I was writing this part of the talk, I struggled because I'm still learning what this means. I hesitate to tell you this, but I looked at my kids' Lego catechism in the car on the way here. And I said, what does the Lego catechism have to say about the sacrament of marriage? It was actually very illustrative. But there are a few things to say here. The first is that, especially when we're discerning, what we want to do with our life and whether we're called to marriage or the contemplative life, I think it's easy to try to think our way into the vocation, to learn as much as possible about it, to try to wrap our heads around what very wise people like Aquinas or John Paul II are saying about it. And for me, this sacramental good by which marriage signifies Christ's union with the church really is something that needs to be lived into. I think that there are many ways to do that. The church is a community of other married couples and other families. So one of the most important things that we've done is befriend older couples who are a little farther along on the journey than we are, and who have wisdom to share. The other thing is that, we also find that when you signify the union between Christ and the church, that also means you're bearing witness to others of what this love looks like, and that this is, and this is especially an emphasis in modern documents like Familiaris Consortio, this is one of the ways that the church shows Christ's love to the world is through the married family. So we always try to behave in public. But also it means that, when we fight, we apologize in front of the children, because the children are learning what God's love looks like through the way that we treat one another. And finally, I think it's important to connect this great mystery, as Paul calls it, with other sacraments in the church, particularly the Eucharist. And so I want to end with this quotation from Familiaris Consortio that talks about the Eucharist. It says, "The Eucharist is the very source of Christian marriage. The Eucharistic sacrifice, in fact, represents Christ's covenant of love with the church, sealed with his blood on the cross. In this sacrifice of the new and eternal covenant, Christian spouses encounter the source from which their own marriage covenant flows, is interiorly structured, and continuously renewed. As a representation of Christ's sacrifice of love for the church, the Eucharist is a fountain of charity. In the Eucharistic gift of charity, the Christian family finds the foundation and soul of its communion and its mission. By partaking in the Eucharistic bread, the different members of the Christian family become one body, which reveals and shares in the wider unity of the church. The sharing in the body of Christ that is given up and in his blood that is shed becomes a never-ending source of missionary and apostolic dynamism for the Christian family. And this is certainly true of our family. I think Nathaniel and I both feel very much that our marriage and family life is nourished by the Eucharist. And the weekly attendance of Mass with our children is certainly part of that. The Eucharist provides a stability to our life. And I think, too, the grace of the sacrament of the Eucharist helps with this dimension of indissolubility. Because we can go to Mass being really mad at one another for something. And then we do the sign of peace. And then we receive the Eucharist. And this is something that we come back to every week regardless. And it's sort of God's way of reminding us, you know, that God is present in our marriage. And this is one of the ways that God is bestowing grace. So to conclude my section, I just went through the natural goods of marriage, procreation, offspring, and being a remedy for sin vis-a-vis fidelity. And I wanted to show how the sacrament itself kind of takes up these natural goods and transforms them into something that sets you on a path to eternal life together. And then in terms of the mystery of the sacrament, which is the third good of marriage, I think that it is hard to think our way into, and it really needs to be lived into. So thank you very much.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith, and it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.